Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 352. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. Another jam-packed episode this week with two guests. Let me introduce the first one to you. Justin Lee is the founder and the executive director of the Gay Christian Network, a nonprofit Christian ministry dedicated to serving as a place for Christ-centered support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals and those who care about them. He has been featured in numerous print, radio, and television venues, including Dr. Phil, Anderson Cooper 360, the Associated Press, and a front page article in the New York Times. He is the director of the 2009 documentary Through My Eyes, all about the debate's impact on young Christians, and he co-hosted the popular long-running podcast GCN Radio. In 2012, Justin published the critically acclaimed book, which I have been tearing through, Torn, Rescuing the Gospel from the Gays versus Christian Debate, and now Justin is here with us. Justin, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hey, thanks. Wow, that was quite an introduction.
You've done a lot of stuff, Justin. Do you have a sense that you've done a lot of stuff?
I'm always just so aware of all the stuff that still needs to happen out there with the way that, unfortunately, a lot of people of faith are talking about the LGBT community.
Yeah.
There's a lot that still needs to be done. So I'm always focused on that. But thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you. Now, it strikes me, look, we've been doing the show for close to 8 years now, and we have so many guests on who talk about their work, but don't necessarily have to talk about their personal journey. In reading up on you and seeing the work that you've done, are you able to separate out your work from your own journey?
No, I mean, I think for me, it's very personal work.
Yeah.
But I don't try to separate it out because ultimately, I think these are personal questions. These are personal stories for all of us. The way that we as LGBT people are impacted by the culture and our faith communities where we have them and our families and their faith and all those things. I mean, these are just deeply personal things. And I think the more we try to have these conversations outside of personal stories, the more we end up with just debates about, you know, marriage and stuff like that. But when we talk about real people and real people's stories, that's where we're able to change hearts and minds and make a difference in the culture. So yeah, it's all about personal story for me.
Yeah. You know, look, when we talk about so many different topics on our show, I feel like faith, this idea of faith, doesn't come up super often. I would imagine that when you're out there doing this work, you do encounter people who are like, no, that's separate from advocacy. And it's very much not, right?
Well, you know, there are a lot of folks in the LGBT community who've been really hurt by communities of faith. So, you know, frankly, when I say that I work for an organization called the Gay Christian Network around Christians, there are a lot of eyebrows raised at the gay part. But if I say that around gay people, there are a lot of eyebrows raised around the Christian part, because a lot of folks are like, look, why do you even want to be part of a faith community like that, particularly a Christian community? But, you know, I think that if we are not able to address the kinds of faith questions that come up for a lot of folks, then we're never going to be able to get through to a lot of people in our own families and people who are, legislators and other folks who have a lot of influence in our lives and in the quality of life of a lot of young people. And so for me, it's like, you know, my faith is personal. And so there's that element to it. But also, I think for the LGBT community as a whole, even for those who would not consider themselves to be people of faith, it's important to have people out there having the faith conversation from an LGBT perspective.
I have the great pleasure every Sunday night of attending a TV night with just four of us. It's not a huge TV night, Justin. It's just four of us. Mm. But it's me and three members of the Gay Christian Network. And so I'm able to see every Sunday. Oh, yeah. No, it's very exciting. I'm able to see the impact it has on their life. Before we talk about everything that the Gay Christian Network actually does, what does it provide for you personally?
Well, I grew up as this really, really conservative evangelical kid in a Southern Baptist church, believing all kinds of anti-gay stuff. And when I first came out to myself, I was lost. I mean, I didn't have any support.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to be okay with myself. There was this question of, you know, is God okay with me, and how do I process all of this? But also there was this question of, do I have a community? I mean, if my faith continues to be a part of my life, and if there's a lot of anti-Christian sentiment among the gay people that I know, and a lot of anti-gay sentiment among the Christians that I know, where is my place? And so, when we first started doing this kind of work, we call it GCN for short.
Yeah.
We started doing this with GCN. I found that it was as much for me in terms of giving me a community and giving me a group of people who understood what I was going through as this kid from this evangelical home who realized he was gay, as much as it was for anybody else. Although, as I've done this, I've now been doing this for 15 years, and the more I've been doing this, I feel like the more my focus is on changing the culture and changing hearts and minds out there, not just trying to create safe community spaces, which is part of what we do, but also trying to make the world a safer place in general for the next generation of LGBT kids.
Yeah. Now, I am never about outing anyone's age. It's not what we do on this show, Justin. But 15 years ago, one could argue that you were perhaps in your early to mid-20s. Is that fair to say?
Back when I was a little boy. Yeah. So I'm 38 now. So you can do the math. Yeah.
They will do the math at home. They'll do the math at home. Now, some of the work that we do when we talk about activism and advocacy, it also comes up every now and then that it can be perhaps slightly ageist, in that the voices of those in their 20s is not often at the table. How were you able to work through that and say, no, wait, there's stuff that we have to do here?
Well, it was tough. You know, when I first started this little nonprofit, I didn't have any connections. You know, I didn't know, you know, when you look at LGBT activism, there are the big organizations like the Human Rights Campaign and the LGBTQ Task Force and folks that are very visible. And I didn't know any of those people. I knew these organizations existed, but I didn't know anyone at these organizations. I didn't have access to any significant funds. I was just a kid on the internet, really. But all I knew to do was to tell my story and to write about what I was going through. And I think one thing that I've always been pretty good at is listening to people from different perspectives and understanding what motivates them. So when I hear somebody say something that is really anti-gay or really anti-trans, it's frustrating, obviously, but I also am pretty good at moving past that to say, okay, what is this person really afraid of? What are they really concerned about? Why are they saying the things that they're saying? And the same thing is true, you know, in any other area where maybe somebody disagrees with me. And so I think that was the thing, the tool that I had that I could use, was I could write and I could put things into language that people from different perspectives could connect with. And so we just started building this little community. And even today, we've been around for 15 years. A lot of people have no idea who we are. And we've had over 30,000 folks connect with us online. We do an annual conference that's the world's largest annual LGBT Christian event. And still, a lot of people don't know who we are. We're not well connected to a lot of the big names people think of, but we just keep doing what we do.
Yeah. What does the executive director of GCN do on a daily basis?
Everything. We have a fairly small staff.
Yeah.
So I end up having to do, you know, whatever needs to get done that somebody else isn't already doing. We've got folks on staff who manage our events, who manage the tech side. I used to, you know, if something needed to go on our website, I used to do that myself. I don't have to do that anymore. We've got someone who manages all that. We've got somebody who manages our social media and communications and stuff. But I still, you know, kind of run the organization from day to day, whatever that means. And it's really different every day. You know, whether it's answering emails and phone calls and coordinating with folks in other organizations, or whether that means traveling and speaking, you know, on Christian college campuses. I do a lot, or talking to the media. I end up having a lot of behind the scenes conversations with influential Christian leaders. So there are folks, for instance, who are considering changing their organization's or church's position on a lot of LGBT issues, who have not made that public yet, but they'll talk to me first and say, this is what we're thinking about, and, you know, I can give advice. So it's a lot of different stuff, but ultimately the goal is always to have the Christian voices out there be more and more affirming, more and more supportive of LGBT folks, and to try to educate folks to eliminate a lot of the harmful stereotypes that exist.
Yeah. You mentioned working with other organizations. Talk to me about the importance of working across different lines, of partnering up with other groups to do even more.
Well, you know, there's so many, I mean, there's a ton of work to be done.
Yeah.
There are a lot of folks, I think, who, when the Supreme Court decided, you know, ruled in favor of marriage equality, a lot of folks sort of, you know, said, well, we're done. That's what we needed to accomplish. And it's just not true.
Right.
There's so much that needs to be done in the United States and around the world. There are people who are suffering every day. And I don't want to, like, bring the mood down, but there are people who are suffering around the world because of who they are. And they often have a lot of allies. They don't have resources. And even in the United States, there are kids growing up in very conservative, often very religious environments who do not have access to the kind of resources that somebody maybe in New York City or Los Angeles might have access to. And particularly for kids who still live at home, their parents, you know, are really their whole world.
Right.
And if their parents are not supportive for religious or other reasons, that can be a terrifying proposition. If you come out and you're like 13 and you know you've got years before you can be on your own, that's really scary. So it's important to us to work with whoever's out there. And so when there's political work to be done, I live in North Carolina where there's, you know, this bill that's made national news that's really harmful to the trans community. So, of course, you know, as soon as that happened, we started talking to our partners in other organizations that are more focused on the political side. And we said, well, how can we help as a religious organization? If there's work that needs to be done, say, to combat the youth LGBT youth homelessness problem, then we talk to organizations that specialize in that. And we say, well, okay, how can we as a faith community be helpful? Who can we help mobilize? Who do we need to be talking to? And when it comes to making changes in churches, we talk to other Christian organizations and we say, all right, you guys specialize in talking to this community. We have a lot of influence, say, with evangelicals. We'll talk to the evangelicals. You talk to the Presbyterians. And, you know, and so that's kind of how we do it. And I just think this is work where, from my perspective, there's no room for organizations to be all about ego or trying to make sure that their name is on everything. Ultimately, what matters is creating a safer world for everybody.
There it is. There it is. Now, apparently there was one day that you just woke up and said, I'm going to write a book. Is that how it happened?
I had been thinking about writing a book for a long time. People kept saying to me, you should write a book. And I kept saying, yeah, one of these days. You mentioned when you introduced me that there was a front page article in the New York Times. That was years ago. And when that happened, it kind of brought us to the attention of a lot of folks. And I got all these phone calls from people saying, oh, do you want to write a book? And we could set you up with a ghostwriter. And I said, no, if I'm going to write a book, I'm going to write it. Somebody's going to write it for me. But I just never had time. But over the years, people kept saying to me, my parents are very religious. They're, you know, really devout Christians. I need to come out to them, or I just have come out to them and they're not supportive. Do you have a book that I could give them that would help them understand? Or my pastor is really conservative. Do you have a book I could recommend to him that would help him kind of understand where I'm coming from? And I never really felt like I had a great book to recommend to a lot of folks in those situations, especially within certain sects of Christianity. And so eventually I just decided I should write one. I knew what needed to be in that kind of a book. And so I was like, well, I guess I should write it. And what I did was I wrote the book within kind of using my personal story as a backdrop for everything. Because I think it's one thing if I say to you, well, you know, here's what the evidence says about why people are gay, where sexual orientation comes from. But it's a quite different thing if I say to you, well, you know, I grew up as this kid, didn't think I was gay, didn't believe that it was okay to be gay, and then I realized that I was, and then I was asking myself, well, what causes people to be gay? And then I did the research and here's what I found out. It has more resonance for people that way. So I wanted to make all these points about what the science says and about what the Bible says and about how the church has gotten this wrong in the past. But I wanted a way to make it relatable for folks, so I told it within the context of my own story. And it seems to have gone over pretty well.
It has gone over really well. Again, listeners, we are here with Justin Lee, the founder and executive director of GCN, the Gay Christian Network. You write in the book this, quote, "We must be willing to seek common ground and shared interests. Perhaps you and the other person have very different views on some things, but both share a concern for the health of gay people who feel hurt by the church. If so, that's a starting point. You can find ways to build on that without having to compromise on your most deeply held values." I think, Justin, that in talking to so many people, you know, like there's a lot of struggle of where do we start? How do we find that common ground? How do you work with the people in your life to really get things moving?
Yeah, you know, I think so often we fixate on the places where we disagree. So, you know, if you're talking to somebody, whether it's a pastor or a leader in your community, you know, politician, family member, but you're talking to somebody who says, well, you know, I don't support marriage for same-sex couples. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Bible is clear in condemning homosexuality. And I always tell people I hate that word homosexuality. It's way too broad, but that's the way it gets used a lot. I think the Bible condemns homosexuality and all this stuff. A lot of times our gut instinct is to focus on that and try to force them to change their mind. And then we start arguing, you know, folks end up arguing about the Bible. You know, well, the Bible says this too, and you don't believe that. And then, you know, you end up in this argument about how to interpret the Bible. And maybe you're not a Christian. You don't even believe what they believe about the Bible. Or maybe you are, but you interpret it differently. But you don't get anywhere just arguing on that point. I think there's a time and place to have those conversations. But I think a lot of times where the conversations are more likely to result in people changing their minds is where we can build first on a foundation of where we agree. So if I'm talking to a Christian who disagrees with me on marriage, I can start by saying, well, okay, we can build on the fact that we're both Christians, and so we have some beliefs in common there. Or we can build on the fact that we both care about the well-being of young people, and we care about the well-being of LGBT young people, and that's a starting point. And then eventually we get to the places where we disagree, but then we're trying to address the same issues, the same problems, even if from different perspectives, and there's a way for us to work together. Whereas if we just focus on the ways that we're different, we just end up villainizing each other and nobody changes their mind. People dig their heels in even further and we just don't accomplish anything.
Yeah. You mentioned young people. We have to take a minute here and talk about conversion therapy, reparative therapy. Mm. How is this not a thing that's banned in all of the states?
Well, it should be.
Yeah.
I mean, I absolutely believe it should be. I mean, reparative therapy, oh my gosh, I could talk your ear off about it, but it has been repeatedly, consistently shown to be not only ineffective at changing people's orientation, which is typically the goal, but also to be just really psychologically harmful to folks. And I would like for it to cease to exist altogether. But at the very least, we need to stop forcing young people into therapy like this. I mean, therapy is not even really a good word for it.
Right.
I've talked to so many young folks who, you know, their parents forced them into so-called therapy with counselors who, in many cases, have little to no credentials, say all kinds of horrible things. I mean, I talked to, you know, a kid who said that his, this, you know, ex-gay counselor repeatedly called him a liar when he, you know, the counselor would say, well, this is the reason that you're attracted to guys. You feel this and you believe that. And the kid said, well, that's not what I feel and that's not what I believe. And the counselor said, oh, you're lying.
Wow.
Well, what kind of therapy is that? You know, and it's just incredibly detrimental to these kids' psychological and emotional health, particularly at a time that many of them are struggling with their religious beliefs. They're struggling with feeling unaccepted by their parents. You know, they're trying to figure out what their future is. This is not when they need to be put in this kind of situation. So, yeah, I mean, I could talk about it all day, but it's got to stop. And I think a lot of that is about educating. It's about both the political, like a lot of these things, there's a political element that needs to happen in terms of putting political pressure on legislators. There's also an education piece that needs to happen in terms of teaching people, religious people and other people, what's really going on, why it matters, and why it needs to be stopped.
Yeah, because so much of it is being done under the guise, under the umbrella of faith, under Christianity, yeah, under religion. I would imagine that's insulting to any number of people who really don't believe that this is a thing.
Yeah, well, it's, from my perspective, it is like so much of the anti-gay, anti-LGBT rhetoric that we hear coming from Christian sources. I think a lot of it is actually dramatically anti-Christian, in my view. And, you know, I try to avoid pointing the finger at any particular person and saying that person's not a real Christian because
right,
that doesn't accomplish anything. But I look at, you know, as you said, the arguments around reparative therapy, the arguments right now being used to prevent trans folks from being able to go to the bathroom, a lot of these kinds of issues. It is absolutely the polar opposite of who I understand Jesus to be. You know, the biblical accounts of Jesus say that he was criticized by the religious establishment of his day for being a friend of sinners, for being someone who spent his time with the outcasts and the people who were most looked down on by society. And he spends his time criticizing the religious establishment. And so we see this American Christianity today that so often has done the exact opposite of what Jesus did. This, you know, American Christianity that is standing for this kind of holier-than-thou religious establishment and opposing the folks who are the outcasts, the folks who are the most vulnerable, and the folks who are deemed to be the sinners. And I just think it's incredibly backwards. And so, you know, I'm not going to get in somebody's face and tell them that they're being a bad Christian. I don't think that really helps, but I do think that there are a lot of folks being bad Christians out there right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's end with a piece of patented Justin Lee advice for all of our listeners out there who are trying to reconcile, find that commonplace between their faith and their sexual orientation and really struggling because of so many of the outside influences that you've mentioned. What's a good place for people to start?
Yeah, you know, I think ultimately, I think everybody's faith journey is going to be their own individual faith journey. I'll say for me, as a Christian, the most important piece toward reconciling my own faith and sexuality was to stop listening to, you know, what all the preachers and all the kind of folks who seemed, you know, all the know-it-alls, all the religious know-it-alls of the world said, and to focus on how Jesus is portrayed in the Bible and what Jesus is about. And that was really the starting point for me. And the more that I studied my own Bible and really read what the Christian faith has been about from the beginning, the more I said, this is something I can hold on to. This faith that is about grace and mercy and love and God caring about and loving every person, especially the people who are the most outcast in the world. That's something I can really get behind. And everything else you build on that, but that that really, really has stuck with me over the years.
Nice, nice. Well, where can all of our listeners go to learn all about the great things that you are doing?
So the Gay Christian Network is on the web at gaychristian.net. I have a blog that I update periodically called Crumbs from the Communion Table. It's on Tumblr. You can find me on Tumblr and everywhere else at GCN Justin, or you can just go to justinlee.co. It's not .com, it's .co, justinlee.co. And that'll take you to my blog and my book and everything else I'm doing.
There's a great piece there called This is What Respectful Disagreement Looks Like. We can disagree with each other, Justin. We just have to do it respectfully, right?
I totally agree with that.
There it is. There Absolutely. It is. Justin, look, I get to see it firsthand at TV night every Sunday. Everything that you are doing is making such a huge difference. And I know that you are not doing it alone. And there really is, in the very definition of a word, the network out there. But my hope is that you know you really are providing that place for people to be their full selves. And it's a great thing.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing. Alleluia, alleluia.
All right, folks, and we are back with our second amazing guest for this week's episode. Furious is an indie dance artist who is going to get you up and out of your seat. He recently released his sophomore album, No Immunity, which was exclusively streamed on New Now Next. We love that. The Advocate premiered his track, Damn Shame, and they wrote this about him. Quote, he delivers tight vocals and catchy lyrics that linger long after the track final beat hits. That sounds pretty darn good to us, so let's welcome him and talk all about the beat. Furious, welcome to the show, It's So Gay.
Hey, thanks, gang. Good to be here.
We have a lot of ground to cover, sir. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, well, we have to start with you as we start with all of our music-affiliated guests. Why the medium of music to get your voice out there?
Well, that's like asking why breathe? Why get up in the morning? There's really no answer because you have to, and that really is the short answer. Like when you choose music, it's more like music chooses you, and it's something that happens. Like it's genetic or cultural, but it just happens at some point, and you just have to do it. And then, of course, there's all these forces of commerce and markets and things that get in the way, and it's more for yourself that gets in the way. But if you just focus on I just have to make music. That's sounds a little trite, but that's the short answer.
Well, question number two was why breathe and why get up in the morning? So I feel like we've covered that now.
Because of the music, right?
There you go. It all works. Yeah. It all works. Was this always the dream when Little Furious was running around in the Bronx? Was it always about music?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess, you know, everyone thinks about music. It's the soundtrack to their lives. They always remember. They always have those memories. But, you know, when you're like 4 and you know the words to every song on the radio and you kind of, you know, start looking at Billboard charts and you know everything about everything and it's a little weird and you're like, okay, maybe this is just more than like music is the soundtrack to my life. Maybe music is a little more important to me than that. And then you start, you know, listening to the Smiths when you're 6 and start, you know, going through every album cut of Stevie Wonder when you're, you know, it's just, it goes beyond and it's just like anyone who has kind of anything that calls them, whether it's sports or medicine, it's just something that just drives you and you just go right toward it.
Yeah. Now, specifically, you live in that wonderful world of dance, and there's so many different influences on your music, and we're going to play some tunes from you, and folks will hear that. But certainly, dance runs throughout the beats in your songs. Was there a point where you said, yes, this is the direction I want to go?
Well, you know, that's interesting because, it wasn't kind of like a direct path there.
Right.
And I think that's kind of, you know, everyone has their own trajectory and mine was definitely through all of the genres that I like, and if there's any problem it's just that I like so much, so I definitely have many different projects and sounds, you know, that's kind of it would always kind of take me back there and I try this and I try this but then I'd always kind of want to go back there. And is that to say that, you know, my next thing won't be kind of an acoustic singer songwriter? Like, it could be because I have that in me too, but I think that whatever it is, it's got to have that, it's got to have some kind of groove, even if it's slow and moody and dark, it'll have a groove.
There you go. There is the most intriguing sentence on your website, which we're going to break down right now. It says, it's good. It's good stuff. He embraces his Euro roots without sacrificing his New York City soul. So let's break down those two pieces. First, talk to me about your Euro roots.
No, I mean, it's just kind of like a reference to, I'm first generation American, my parents were born there, but it's more of a reference to kind of Euro dance music. I think there was a time, and maybe not as much, where dance was kind of kept swept under the rug here.
Right.
I did kind of up and leave New York, and I went to Europe because I had this idea that, as amazing as New York is, that Europe was just freer.
Yeah.
And you could just explore everything. And dance was definitely not, you know, frowned upon. So, yeah, I definitely went to that. And but, you know, at the same time, you know, New York is badass. And it's interesting that the different perspectives that you have when you're in different places and you feel, you know, more New Yorker when you're in Europe and more European when you're in New York. And I think, you know, if you can use those things to your advantage, you get better perspective.
Nice. I feel like I hear New York, that New York soul.
Maybe because
I'm a New York City guy. I feel like I hear that New York City soul in your songs.
I hope so. I mean, I hope so. And I think New York, too, is, you know, I think, you know, part of the goal with this album, particularly No Immunity, was we were thinking about this kind of space in New York in the 80s that's kind of mythologized, where all these sounds were blending together, and the punk kids and new wave kids and the hip hop kids and everybody, you know, would just meet and they could play all these records together. I mean, obviously that's like a Lifetime movie or something, the way people think about it. But it's true, you know, if you go through, you know, some of the Paradise Garage playlists and you see the songs that they were playing are so eclectic but so great. And, we were just trying to capture that. Like, you know, we could move into this, but it's still the same artist, it's still the same party, basically.
There it is. We have to talk about the track Damn Shame, because I know there was a lot of press about that. Tell people about the background of that track.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to keep it very light, and the track is light. But yeah, it was. It's a track about, you know, straight guys kicking it to you and trying to keep their other stuff secret, trying to keep you a secret. And I know a lot of my gay friends get caught up in that. They think it's attractive, and it's, you know, I got some comments from that piece that the song was biphobic, and I can see where that came from. But my whole thing is get everything out in the open. If it's all in the open, then no judgment. Do whoever you have to do. But you know, that song, and that song in particular, was speaking to people who are still kind of compartmentalizing their lives and kind of keeping that secret and that shame. So, and the song title was just, it's a damn shame that they have to live like that, really.
Yeah.
And it was a play on always hearing, ah, damn shame, he's gay. You know, what a waste. And that always killed me when I heard that, because it's like, no, actually, it's an amazing thing. So it's just a little play on that word shame, because, you know, we all have to deal with that in some form or another.
Indeed, indeed.
And then just put a nice groove to it, you know?
Because we got to get people moving, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of the things of, you know, the history of dance music and the history of gay music. I mean, they combine, and that's it right there. It's kind of celebrating, overcoming. And, you know, I do like a moment to pause and reflect also while I'm dancing, and I think that you don't see that as much anymore, because it's easy to talk about easy things and sex and relationships, but you can also do it in a way that, you know, is a cause for reflection and to rethink the kind of the therapeutic benefits of dance music.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with indie dance artist Furious. Now, sir, is it possible to be an indie dance artist and not be just the best dancer? Because I feel like I'm an indie dance artist, but then I remember that I can't really dance at all, and I don't put out music, so it kind of kills it. But I think it's the dance piece that really prevents me.
the question is, do you have to be able to dance to be an indie dance artist?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've seen some good ones who lack a little rhythm. I don't know. I mean, I definitely I love to dance.
Yeah.
But I don't know that, I think that is the most important thing, is to love to dance and kind of lose yourself and not give a shit what you look like or if you're on the beat or not. And who cares if, you know, it's embarrassing you or someone else. And that is like, that is the essence of, you know, being a dancer, really.
Yeah.
There's a track I covered on the album, which is my next single, called Dance, Dance, Dance by Licky Lee, which is an artist I love, song I love. And I think it really comes to that, like coming into yourself. She uses this, I was a dancer all along, but it's kind of, it's a song about coming into yourself and not caring. So, you know, and dancing is kind of about that too. You don't have to be a good dancer, but it's about being comfortable in your skin.
Now, if our listeners enroll in the upcoming course, Learn How to Dance with Furious, what will be the signature move that you teach? Do you have like a signature move that you always find that you bust out?
No. No, I don't. That's a hard one.
As in, teach me how to dance, man. Come on, I need tips here.
What do you like to dance to, Ken?
I will take anything. I will take anything. I grew up as a gay Jew in New Jersey, so you can't go to a bar mitzvah every weekend without just dancing around the dance floor. But yeah,
right.
I'm an '80s dance kind of guy.
Like a Carlton dance kind of guy?
Okay, I wouldn't say, that's fascinating that's immediately where you went with me. I can see perhaps some similarities. I would say more Molly Ringwald in The Breakfast Club.
Okay.
I feel like that's me.
That's pretty fabulous right there. So yeah, I mean, I would say, I don't need to teach you a damn thing. You just run with that.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
I am so excited for your upcoming track about Molly Ringwald in The Breakfast Club. I think it's coming.
I think I'm going to work on it right as soon as I get off this call.
Oh, it's my first time inspiring a song. That's very exciting.
And get my pink ruffle on.
Yes. That's awesome. Well, you have this new album out. Tell me about how you have evolved from your first work to No Immunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both records, I was primarily collaborating with one person. And the first record was a little bit, it was very indie dance, but this one was definitely more house. And it was definitely because I was working with a house producer who's an amazing producer by the name of Scuola Furano. And I did some songs for his record, and we totally just bonded. And we took it from there, and we talked about kind of what I mentioned of creating this kind of playlist, this little party, and have it be eclectic and go from disco funk to like real house. So yeah, it was definitely, we had different references in mind, and it was definitely a bit 80s, but early 90s house as well. And we just kept it there and went through, and I'm really happy with what came out of it. So
nice.
I'm excited to get the rest of the singles out for sure.
Now, what is the connection between you and these music videos? How do you, when you are writing a song, do you visualize it? Is it a whole process whereby you say, oh, you know what, this is what might look good in a video?
Right. Well, yeah, I do. I'm actually working on new EPs and another album, and I already kind of have things in my head. But that can also change, and when you have certain directors, I think it's important to, especially with video directors, because you can force your concept on them, and if they don't believe in that, if it's not totally them, then it just won't ever turn out that way. And if I was an accomplished video director, then I could do it myself, but I can't. So I think it's important. I do love the collaboration. I love, that's my favorite part of the process. And kind of marrying two ideas together, but, you know, without compromise, but and music videos is an interesting one, because you have to really consider the song, but also the budget and being able to execute an idea within that. Because some of the ideas you can do amazing videos for very, very little. And then sometimes you have a very ambitious, and people try to do that ambitious video for something they should have just stopped and said, no, it's just not going to work out. And I think you have to play it all the way through and say, yeah, it's just not going to look that good, because the moment it doesn't look that good, or and the viewer has that moment, it takes them out of the song, it takes them out of the mood, and they'll never watch it again. And that's you want to just create something that enhances the song. So that, I think you always have to keep that like foremost in your mind, something that is going to give the song something else.
Nice.
An attachment to it. And yeah, so the last video was a total back and forth, and he had an idea for this for the No Immunity, my last video, No Immunity, this crazy mouth to be following around. And the song for me was about the kind of demons that haunt you at the end of a relationship. So I wanted to show the end of this kind of gay breakup, and we went back and forth on all these ideas, and it was a great, great collaboration.
It's so great to watch.
Yeah, it changes every time with who you're with, but you just kind of have to be honest with yourselves about what you can accomplish, what you want to accomplish, and be realistic about it, for sure.
Well, another part of your life is being live on stage, and I have watched clips of you live on stage. You look like you're into it and just having a great time.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, you know, I always say my favorite thing is being in the studio and the process of writing a song when you come up with a melody. But then I'm like, no, it's not. My favorite part is being on stage. And then, you know. Yeah, it's kind of like when you're at a party and you're lost, and that's what it is for me. So that really is the ultimate, and I can't wait to perform these songs, because they're meant to be performed, for sure.
Nice. Well, tell all of our listeners what you have coming up that you are excited about. I mean, there's so much happening.
Yeah, I have a new single, Dance, 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 and video coming out. I, as I tend to do, have just been already in the studio, and I have kind of a new album on the way.
Can you not just enjoy the one that's out right now?
Exactly.
Do we have to move on to another one?
But you can't really ever enjoy the one that's out, because you always want the new one, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I don't want to rush this one, but there's definitely going to be even some new music coming out later this year, and we'll see it either at the end of the year or at the beginning of next year, another new album and videos and getting these songs out performed live. So all that is in the works for sure.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, listeners, this is what you all need to do. You need to head on out to where fine music is sold, perhaps go on over to iTunes, and type in Furious, and the new album, No Immunity, will pop right up. I will tell you, I enjoy the song Crumble. That's my favorite.
I've gotten that a lot. I've gotten some requests for that to be the third single, and we'll see. But yeah. I will add that to the list.
Okay, because I would bust out my Molly Ringwald moves for Crumble.
I would like to see that.
Yeah, so would a lot of people. In fact, no one would like to see that, just putting that out there. And of course, listeners, you need to stroll on over to furious.com. We will link to it for you. Look, there is nothing that I like more than a guest who is trying to lift our spirits, to get us moving, and to put us in a different place. And your music does that, man. It's really great stuff.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
All right. Please keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, I definitely will.
Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, but still some news to get to. But first, if you have a spare 18 seconds in your day, not asking you for any money, but 18 seconds, if you could, stroll on over to podcastawards.com. That's podcastawards.com, and you'll see a GLBT category. And so This Show Is So Gay is trying for the third year in a row to be nominated for Best GLBT Podcast in the Podcast Awards. It has been such an honor being nominated the past 2 years, and we want to make it 3 years in a row that we've been nominated. So you go to podcastawards.com. Over in the GLBT category, you just type in our show name, which is This Show Is So Gay, and our URL, which is thisshowissogay.com. And then you scroll down, and on the bottom left, you'll see a place to put your name and your email address. It's actually not a spam type of thing. They're not trying to build their mailing list. They're just trying to verify the votes, because it's only one vote per email address. So you click submit after you enter in your name and your email address, and then just check your mail to see if they want you to verify it, and that's it. It really and truly takes 18 seconds. Podcastawards.com. If you are so inclined and you enjoy our content, This Show Is So Gay, hopefully third year in a row being nominated. But for right now, let's get to some news out there. Again, the North Carolina story keeps developing and developing. A recent federal court ruling has now overrided North Carolina's anti-LGBT bill. Governor Pat McCrory has said that he will not stand in the way of this federal court ruling. This week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 4th District ruled in a 2-1 decision in favor of Gavin Grant, a trans student who sued his Virginia high school after administrators blocked him from using the men's room. The decision will also affect Maryland, West Virginia, and South Carolina, which are the other states in the 4th District. As The Advocate had previously reported, the ruling will have far-reaching effects on the debate over which bathrooms and locker rooms transgender people can use. At the center of that discussion is, of course, North Carolina's House Bill 2, a controversial anti-LGBT bill signed into law on March 23rd. While striking down local non-discrimination ordinances across the state, the bill also requires trans people to use public restrooms and locker rooms that do not correspond with their gender identity. Governor McCrory, he has walked back some of the parts of House Bill 2, but not the part about the bathrooms. But it would seem now that a recent federal court ruling will override this part of North Carolina's recently passed anti-LGBT bill. But again, there are these pieces of this LGBT bill that are still so discriminatory. And so we are seeing more and more different companies and different artists saying, we're just not going to perform there. One of the biggest in the past week, Target. Target is taking a stand against North Carolina's transphobic bathroom bill, saying its customers and employees can use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. The company announced the policy on their corporate website this week, saying, quote, inclusivity is a core belief at Target. It's something we celebrate. Let's say that again. Inclusivity is a core belief at Target. It's something we celebrate. I love that word, celebrate. It's not about being tolerant. It's not about just merely welcoming people to the table. It's actually celebrating them. Target even proclaimed its support for the Equality Act that is proposed in Congress. They said this, quote, we believe that everyone, every team member, every guest, and every community deserves to be protected from discrimination and treated equally. Consistent with this belief, Target supports the Federal Equality Act, which provides protections to LGBT individuals and opposes action that enables discrimination. There you go. Target. We love it. When these companies use their voice, when these various musical artists use their voice and say, hey, we're not going to your state, Bruce Springsteen, Bryan Adams, so many others saying, we're canceling our concerts in Mississippi and North Carolina because this is not what we are about. Now, yes, there are some fans who are upset, but these artists are making a very clear statement, and it is discrimination just will not stand. And we certainly will not support discrimination with our money, right? There's an actual economic impact to all of this, and this is what these artists are showing. In Tennessee, Tennessee's anti-trans bathroom bill has gone down the drain again, and it will apparently stay there for at least a year. In March, a legislative committee had delayed action on this bathroom bill by sending it to a summer study session, but the committee, under pressure from the far-right Family Action Council of Tennessee, revived it, as we covered in early April. This week, its sponsor in the House of Representatives, Susan Lynn, said she would withdraw the bill until next year. The measure, House Bill 2414, and its companion legislation, Senate Bill 2387, would have barred transgender students in public elementary and secondary schools, colleges, and universities from using the restrooms, locker rooms, and other sex-segregated facilities that correspond with their gender identity. Representative Susan Lynn said this, quote, I have learned that our school districts are largely following what the bill says. I am still absolutely 100% in support of maintaining the privacy of all students, but I'm going to roll the bill over until next year so we can work on those issues. This is what we are spending our time on. It's not the economy. It's not the defense of our country. It's about who can use what bathroom. As if there are people causing problems in the bathrooms, which they are not. They are absolutely not. But yeah, there you go, Tennessee. If you're listening and you live in Tennessee, this is what your representatives are spending time on. You might want to send them an email and say, hey, maybe focus on other stuff. Maybe focus on other stuff. So this is kind of a happy story for me. So Tracy Morgan, so when I said people were canceling things all over, different artists, Tracy Morgan is one of them. Now this is very significant for me because years and years ago, maybe in the second year of this show Is So Gay, Tracy Morgan made some really horrible homophobic comments, and I talked about them on the air. This is back when we were broadcasting in Brattleboro, Vermont. Shout out Brattleboro. I know you guys are listening to us on Monday nights on WVEWLP, Brattleboro Community Radio, where this show Is So Gay got its start. Well, Tracy Morgan made these horrible comments, and I said on the air, well, that's it. You know, I was going to start watching 30 Rock, but it's hard for me to support this artist, this comedian, who was saying such horrible things. And he had actually said, he really flat out said in his stand-up that gay kids, they should just kill themselves. Well, he has turned the corner in an amazing way. He has canceled his Mississippi performance. As the Advocate notes, he has come a long way since having to apologize for his anti-gay tirade in 2011, again, when he joked on stage that he'd kill his own son if he were effeminate. So I like seeing when people make progress and they evolve. This might even mean that I might watch 30 Rock. I've never seen 30 Rock before. I'm one of those people, all my friends tell me that's one of those shows that I would just adore, but I've never seen it because it was difficult for me to see this guy on screen who I know joked that he would kill his own son if he were effeminate. And I was thinking, no, this is not who I want to be supporting. But yay for Tracy Morgan, who has canceled his Mississippi performance. Exciting news in Salt Lake City. Cool things happening in Utah. The Salt Lake City Council has decided to name a street after pioneering gay leader Harvey Milk, which is the latest display of Salt Lake City's position as a blue island in a sea of deep red, where the prevailing Mormon faith has a fraught relationship with the LGBT community. Utah's capital city recently elected its first openly gay mayor and its second sitting gay councilman, which created an increasingly friendly atmosphere for the LGBT community in the home of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The conservative religion's tone on gay issues has softened in recent years, but it still opposes same-sex marriage. The Mormon faith still believes homosexuality is a sin and recently banned baptisms for children of gay parents. We definitely covered that story. Faith leaders have said the highly criticized move would avoid putting children in a tug of war between their parents and church teachings. Well, this week, the Mormon church declined to comment on the council's unanimous vote on Tuesday to rename the street. Sponsor Stan Penford, the city's first openly gay councilman, said that leaders likely would have reached out if they had strong opposition. So we are okay with silence on this one. Harvey Milk set the tone for the modern gay rights movement. I have said so many times before, Harvey Milk, my absolute hero. So yeah, the city of Salt Lake City making a bold statement honoring Harvey Milk. And I'm telling you, there are different levels. First, you need to know who Harvey Milk is. And then if you want to up the ante a little, you can watch Milk, which is the Sean Penn biopic. It's okay. It's pretty good. And then if you want to up the ante more, you want to watch the 1982-1983 documentary, The Life and Times of Harvey Milk. Amazing documentary, won the Oscar that year. But then, if you really want to up the ante, and I'm recommending that you do so, you must read Randy Schilt's masterpiece, The Mayor of Castro Street. As I've said over and over again, not that you need insight into what's happening in my bedroom, but I will still tell you, yes, The Mayor of Castro Street is the only book that permanently sits on my bedside table. Books come and go pretty much weekly in my life on my bedside table, but The Mayor of Castro Street always stays there. So go check it out. Go learn, and kudos to you, Salt Lake City. Our huge thanks to Justin Lee and everybody doing such incredible work over at the Gay Christian Network, GCN, and of course to Furious, who is getting our feet moving. Go check out his music. You guys, we have so many amazing original episodes, new episodes coming up in the next few weeks. Just legendary, legendary filmmaker J.D. DeSalvatore will be on next week's show. So looking forward to speaking with her. You guys, get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ and ally brothers and sisters. Whatever it is that you do best, I don't know what it is you do. You will make a difference by using your voice, and I promise you, you will feel great after you do so. So get out there, use your voice, make a difference. And while you're out there making a difference and using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?